where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. I am your host, Alex Marcus, and when I am not talking to you about movies, I am the podcast editor for thepropbreak.com. Joining me today, my co-host for this podcast and co-host of the Rush podcast, Podwork Angels, it's Noah France. How are you, Noah?
Hello. My mind may be beautiful, but do you know what is not beautiful?
Taxes? What?
Heat waves.
Ah, of course.
Heat waves make even the prettiest visage sweaty.
And we will be talking about either a beautiful mind or an unbeautiful heat wave in a few minutes. But till we get there, I'd want to let everyone know that sadly my other co-host, Justin Mancini, will not be with us today. But in his stead, we are so excited to welcome onto the show one half of the great Blurred Life with My Wife podcast and Blurred Watchers and the Twitch channel host, the Okami Council. It's Marshall Stevenson. How are you today, Marshall?
Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Marshall is joining us today for another installment in our flashback series of episodes where we invite a guest onto the show to discuss one of their all-time favorite films. And Marshall has selected the 2001 Best Picture winning film, A Beautiful Mind, written by Akiva Goldsman, starring Russell Crowe, Jennifer Connelly, Ed Harris, Paul Bettany, Christopher Plummer, and Adam Goldberg, and directed by legendary director Ron Howard. Before we get into our review of this film, Marshall, I wanted to ask you about your history with it. What was your first or most memorable viewing of this film, and what makes it one of your favorites?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was younger when it came out. It came out in 2001, so I think at that time I was 2001 was 13. I probably saw it around 2002 or 2003. So I was probably in high school. And what I love about this film, now, of course, I can't speak for any of that representation for anyone with dissociative identity disorder. That is going to be completely removed from my thoughts and arguments or anything of that nature, because, of course, I do not suffer from the affliction and the condition. And I would like to, you know, first say that everyone who does suffer, I hope that this movie represented you guys well. But if it did not, this is just my artistic examination of the film.
And it's actually schizophrenia that John Nash suffered from, not dissociative identity disorder.
Sometimes they're used okay, cool. So with that said, for anyone who suffers, I want to make sure that I'm just examining from the artistic standpoint. But at the time when I was, you know, my formative years, you know, music, movies, they kind of stick with you. And the examination of this man's genius and how it walked hand in hand with his psychopathy was just mind-boggling to me. And it was a beautiful love story as well. It was a movie about a beautiful mind, and I just thought that it was very aptly named, and it's always stuck with me through multiple repeated viewings, seeing things just a little bit differently every time, the twists and turns of how he comes to understand his condition and later manipulate it and ultimately overcome it to become, you know, one of the, you know, best mathematicians, you know, of his time, and, you know, code breakers and everything. It's just a great story. I love time stories. I love stories that extend beyond, you know, 3 months. Like, I like seeing years of people's lives. I like seeing how they develop. And I think it is the best vehicle for character development, because not everything happens in a short amount of time. TLDR, it's a good fucking movie, and I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Makes sense. Now, Noah, what is your familiarity with this film ahead of watching it for the podcast?
I had seen it once before, way back in college when I was getting into movies. And I was just going through without any particular rhyme or reason when I had when I saw a title or I got access to a certain title. I thought, oh, everyone says that's a good movie. I'll watch that now. And at some point within that time period is when I first watched A Beautiful Mind. I had not seen it again from start to finish until I sat down to rewatch it yesterday. And in the interim, I have to say that for a while, I had less interest in revisiting the film because I remembered enjoying it when I watched it. But I'd grown to learn more about the inaccuracies in it. And as is the case for, you know, most mainstream Hollywood biopics, there is a lot of altering of the facts of characters. You know, I mean, most especially the fact that the primary relationship between John Nash and his wife in the movie, they split up for multiple decades. Like, they did not have like a strong lifelong marriage. Like, it was obviously much more messy and complicated than that. That's usually the case for those sorts of movies. I also I found myself becoming more critical of the movie as I became aware of how it altered its depiction of what John Nash's actual experience was. The real life John Nash did not have any visions and did not see things. He heard voices and suffered from paranoid delusions. So he did. The aspects of him feeling that he was being followed by some sort of conspiracy, that is accurate. But there weren't. He didn't have, you know, decades long relationships with imaginary characters like that was kind of built up for the film for narrative purposes. So because of that, I felt myself feeling more critical towards the film. And when I went back to revisit it, I expected to not really enjoy it. But I did. I was able. There were a couple of moments or some aspects of the editing that I think are very much of its time that I'm not as much of a fan of, like particularly that scene where. The one, in air quotes, I think, legitimate scene where he's working for the government and it has like this weird editing of like his face is in front of a green screen and like the scene behind his face keeps changing. Little stuff like that. But other than that, you know, it's easy for us to forget that Ron Howard is just a damn good filmmaker and he can take pretty much anything and make you care about it for 2 hours. And I ended up feeling like revisiting it actually helped me to reappraise it in a positive sense in my mind and realize that, okay, like the quips I had or the historical inaccuracies are less important than the themes and the feelings that it's trying to convey. And I went back and read and John Nash was apparently complimentary of the film and said, like, even where it wasn't accurately like depicting my life, it was capturing the essence of what it felt like for me and what I was going through at the time.
Cool. So, yeah. You touched on a lot of stuff that we're going to get into in a few minutes, but I wanted to start out with my experience with this film initially, because it actually holds like a very special place in my heart as well. This movie came out when I was 11, and it was the first film that I remember being very aware of in terms of the Oscar race and things of that nature. And I'm, of course, longtime listeners of this podcast will know I'm a huge Oscars fan. I follow the races every year. I'm very invested in it, even when it drives me crazy. And this is really like my Oscar origin moment, to steal a segment title from one of my favorite podcasts, This Had Oscar Buzz, because basically the story of it is that I had a teacher, a French teacher in middle school, who was a huge fan of Princeton University. She had a daughter who went to Princeton, and she had a lot of pride in that as a university, and especially like we live in New Jersey, so it's a prestigious organization that's in New Jersey. And so she would always talk to us about it. And when they were filming this movie when on the set of Princeton, it was like a huge deal to her. And she kept talking to us about it, like, oh, Russell Crowe is on campus and they're filming about this great mathematician. And it's so cool that they're making a movie about this famous academic person and all that stuff. And so it really kind of like built it up in my mind as like this really big deal thing that was happening, and it was happening right in our backyard and how cool that was. And so I really tracked it as it was developing and becoming a film, and when it was released and it had all this awards buzz, I was like very invested in it. I was like, we have to go see it. I dragged my mom to see it in theaters with me. I'm probably the only 11-year-old in the audience at the time, and I remember really liking it when I watched it for the first time. It's one of the first kind of biopics that I'd ever seen, probably. So some of the stuff that maybe I don't necessarily love now definitely was like, wow, this is incredible at the time, and everything about it blew me away, and I was really invested in its Oscar narrative. And when it won Best Picture and Best Director, I was so excited. And then I like just didn't think about it again for a really long time. And like Noah, I like learned a lot about the true life John Nash, and that kind of complicated my feelings about the film. So I was very interested, Marshall, to have the opportunity to revisit it after all of this time. And I'm glad that I did, because, you know, I think that nothing is going to recapture that initial experience of watching it when I did in such an impressionable age. But I think there's a lot there that's really interesting and worth discussing today. And I'm excited to do so. And I think we have to start out by talking about, like, you know, the person at the center of this film, Russell Crowe, who gives a really an Oscar nominated performance. And He was a gigantic movie star at this when this movie came out, and being a getting cast as a eccentric mathematician would not have been everyone's first guess. He's coming off of Gladiator, right? He has a history of kind of being these kind of brooding figures of alpha male kind of figures in cinema. So I'm very curious, Marshall, what do you think about his performance in this movie?
Oh, it was true. His performance, it was so transformative for me because, yes, just seeing Maximus, like, just coming off of that performance, we saw Gladiator, and I want to say probably like the next month I saw Beautiful Mind, and part of that was because of Gladiator. I was like, oh, Russell Crowe is like a really great actor. Like, what's this other movie? You know, I'm in high school, I got time to just do shit. But it was so performative for me because his physical acting in this movie was surprising, because you would think like, okay, he's playing a mathematician, but he's going to beat everybody's ass. He's going to basically be walking around like, you know, I can fuck you up. But the way it really reminded me, and I guess the best analogy that I could use is Christopher Reeve. When he is Superman, his presence is so much more commanding. When he is Clark Kent, he's very much more docile. He's very much more small. He shrinks himself. And I feel like that's what Russell Crowe did to very, very good points in the movie until he began to come upon his own. I think there's a scene when he was first working for the military where I felt like he was bigger. He was more confident. He was grown. He had finished, you know, all of his undergraduate work. He had won this, you know, this placement, and you could see the confidence. But in the beginning of the movie was such where the performance grabs you is the beginning of the movie, and you see this powerful man, this big guy be small, and you know, there are tints of maybe, you know, his anxiety and different things, maybe different things that he's afflicted with. And I really enjoyed the performance. I mean, everyone in the movie was strong. Big fan of Ed Harris. I thought he was brilliant in the movie as well. Jennifer Connelly is always going to be bae since The Labyrinth. And I've been in love with her since I was 14, and it just won't go away. But Russell, man, he cemented himself in my mind at a young age as this is someone whose career I'll probably watch for the rest of my life.
Yeah, and that like late 90s, early 2000s run of his is just really, when you look back on it, it's just so impressive. You know, like, he starts out with L.A. Confidential. Have you ever seen The Insider, the Michael Mann film that he made in 1999?
Haven't been back that far yet. I'm aware of it, but I haven't seen it.
You gotta watch it. It's fantastic. It's about, he plays this sort of like corporate whistleblower, that working with Al Pacino's journalist character to kind of like blow the whistle on this corporation that is like polluting with chemicals and stuff like that. He's so great in it. And then he's a little bit of a little similar to what he's doing in A Beautiful Mind, more similar than Gladiator, but more of that sort of like in The Insider, he plays sort of this character who feels like this person who has been quiet and like put down upon his whole life, that is like resistant of that and trying to break out of that. But also, you know, up against something that's tremendously intimidating, and the way that he plays that is really fantastic. And so I feel like there's echoes to his Insider performance that I saw in his Nash.
Yeah, I mean, and The Insider kicked off his trilogy of Oscar nominations that concluded with A Beautiful Mind. 2000, he was nominated for The Insider. 2001, he was nominated for Gladiator and won. Yes, yep. Won for Gladiator, and then was nominated for Beautiful Mind. So this was kind of his moment. He became one of those actors who had like multiple nominations and awards, like major awards recognition within a short span of time. So yeah, this is very much this.
And then what's crazy is that after that, then he's never been nominated again, which is wild, because he's had a lot of interesting ebbs and flows in his career since then. But there's a number of performances over the years that I would have thought would have at least hit Oscar radar.
We could do a whole series on Russell Crowe, the person. I think that's its own topic.
But Noah, what did you think about him as John Nash?
Revisiting the performance, I think the performance is definitely a big part of what continues to make the movie work. Although, I mean, like I said, with Ron Howard, the craft is there as well. But it's definitely the performance held up a lot better in my mind than I thought it would. Like, I expected to just find it really cringy. There are some moments at the beginning where I feel they're being a little stereotypical and like, oh, he's so quirky. He's chasing pigeons around the Princeton campus. Isn't that weird? But he ties it together in a really good way. And I think I agree with what you're saying, Marshall. I think there's sort of a lot of people have lost. And I feel like this is something that older movies, when people didn't really care as much about effectively, like accurately looking older or younger. They just did it and used whatever makeup they needed to like get the point across. But no one really cared like, oh, that's not how an old person really looks. There is something too, just giving a person this performance where they can span across multiple decades or even the entirety of a character's adult life, and really get the chance to kind of, you know, uniformly kind of portray how they develop from when they're a young adult to when they're an old person. And I think it is amazing how he really manages to tie all that together, especially by the end. And there are a lot of things with his mannerisms, things that are said to him that are sort of repeated over the course of the film, are all things that add to that. So this revisiting it, I mean, I've always been a huge fan of Gladiator, but I think this and Gladiator are probably, I mean, I think these might be my two favorite performances of his.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah. I would definitely not list this as one of my favorite performances of his, just because I think that he sometimes is very, very effective in the role, but sometimes he kind of falls victim of that I'm an actor playing a person with a disability kind of trope, where kind of like playing up the affectations a little bit that felt very actory. And I was a little disappointed given he can be such a naturalistic performer.
I expected to really sink the movie for me.
But there are a lot of moments that he finds, I think, especially with Jennifer Connelly. I think that he's so great in those scenes, and I think that they're so great together. And that actually brings me to the next thing I want to talk about, which is Jennifer Connelly. You know, Marshall, you mentioned earlier that you've had a crush on her your entire life, and I totally get that. I wish we had you on to talk about Top Gun Maverick, because I bet that would have been interesting. Oh, you haven't seen it yet? Okay, well, he hasn't seen it yet. Get ready. I mean, you might need to watch that alone, because it might be a little overwhelming of an experience, because she is, like, incredibly gorgeous and just the coolest person that ever lived in that movie.
I believe it.
It's like somehow every single shot of her in that movie has her hair, like, windswept. I don't understand how they pulled that off, but yeah, she's really cool. She makes Tom Cruise look like a total dork, and that's, you know, not always the easiest thing to do. But in this movie, she is with someone who is trying to look like a dork, and I'm curious what you think about her performance, Marshall.
Very clearly the baddest girl at the school, and she had that energy throughout her performance, inquisitive, just confident, sexy. You know, it's really not hard to see why in the contents of this film, she would intrigue someone of John Nash's, you know, mind. You know what I mean? Just like, oh, hi. You know, like, it's very, that's very much what she gave in the performance. And, you know, she has some amazing scenes, particularly later in their life when, you know, they were trying to be intimate, you know, and just the frustration of the support that she felt that John deserved and needed, but what it was doing to her. And I thought that was a very, very engaging side plot of this is Alicia's journey too. And not so much as pronounced, but you could see it. And I would definitely believe that they had time frames and time periods where they were separated in their lives. There's a reason why there's a monumentous, you know, time skip toward the end of the film. Because I'm sure, you know, it's not easy. And, you know, like I said, with respect to the artistic, expression in the film, not so much as the accuracy, because this movie, it's hard for me to be critical of it from that standpoint. That's why I'm glad you guys are here, because I can only look at it as that 14-year-old that just watched an amazing movie for the first time, and being able to separate that out is very difficult for me for a movie such as this. But just Jennifer Connelly does this acting with her eyes and her look that I think is very hard to emulate. There are some people that can do it, but for her, it was just the creme de la creme performances for her, because she didn't have as much screen time, but every scene she was in, magnetic, and they had great chemistry.
Yeah. And I think what's really something that surprised me, because it's been so long since I've seen this, is how much of the middle of the movie is actually her movie. She really kind of takes over once it becomes clear that he is ill and he is, you know, institutionalized. It suddenly becomes much more her movie than his. And I think she just, her presence in the film as it slowly grows, you just become more, you just root for this woman so much, and you find her devotion to her husband very inspiring, and just how harrowing it must have been to be in that experience. You're with this person who you love and you trust and you support, and he's having an entirely different life than you realize, in large part. And that is, you know, I think she does a really good job of conveying all of that. And I agree, she has this quality, she has this like emotional openness in her performance. There's this vulnerability and intelligence in her eyes at all times that really kind of just pulls you in and makes you want to root for her and make you feel how she's feeling in a way that not a lot of actors can pull off. I think she's by far the best thing about this movie, in my opinion. I just love her performance. I think especially, you know, when you think about when she, that scene where she is, she thinks that John is kind of like on the upswing, and it turns out he hasn't been taking his medication, and she discovers the garage completely like destroyed with all of these papers and things like that. And then she runs upstairs and she sees that like this man has almost drowned their child because he's entrusting a person who isn't even there. And just like the horror of it, and just that moment of like, I care about this person so much, but I need to protect myself and my child too. And I don't know how to do all of that at once. It just, really just a truly harrowing experience that they really find the emotional honesty to, even in the context of this very kind of Hollywood version of this story. So I think that really is a testament to her performance, especially in that scene.
I think that whole sequence might be, especially from just a broader filmmaking perspective, I think that might be the highlight of the movie for me, because it's so intense and it's incredibly well set up. And I have to say, I do appreciate the fact that they don't once it becomes clear he's not taking his meds, he's falling back into these delusions. The movie doesn't like play around too much before just getting to, and here's why this is really bad. Like, it's not a harmless game. Like, this is actual, this could cause actual harm. It goes straight to it, and it's really well set up. It's hard when Russell Crowe is like attacking the Phantom Ed Harris. But basically anyone else, including Jennifer Connelly, would be like, he just assaulted his wife and almost killed his child. It'd be really easy to make a scene like that feel a bit ham-fisted, but they pull it off where you feel the intensity of the scene and you completely understand why Nash is reacting that way, because he believes a guy is about to shoot his wife. But of course, the effect is he knocks his wife over while holding a baby child. So you totally get, okay, she's got to get out of there. Like, she has to get in the car. Like, that's it. Yeah, no, that's I can't compliment that scene enough. And I gotta say, I definitely agree with you, Alex. For me, like Jennifer Connelly, that would have made this film even better if there had been more focus on their relationship and maybe a little even more room for her character and Russell Crowe to kind of interact with each other. Because I do feel like, looking at it now, one point that I do find a bit critical is the scene, like, they have the one scene with the stars. He's tracing shapes for her in the stars. And that's a really beautiful scene. But other than that, we don't get much of a sense of, okay, what made these two fall in love with each other? Just sort of, it feels a bit rushed for me. Or at the very least, it's like, okay, we've seen enough of John Nash to be like, why is this super intelligent, super competent, you know, woman, like, putting up with this guy? Like, what does she see in this guy? And like, that scene gives you a hint. I wish there'd been a little bit more of that, but I think what you guys are saying are correct. Like the scenes that Jennifer Connelly has, she uses them to the fullest extent of her power. I actually just checked. So this was the film that got her Oscar. She beat out Helen Mirren, Maggie Smith, and Kate Winslet. There were some heavy competitions.
I fully agree. I think that I think she gives a really strong performance. And it, going back to what you said regarding like having enough time to believe in their love story, I feel like that might be one of the problems with the film in the sense of it has so much stuff going on and so much that it needs to get through that it can only take us a small amount of time to invest us in this relationship. But I think that what it does do is it gives us a couple of key scenes where you see the moment where like each person has really like intrigued and encaptured the other's attention romantically. And I think that those scenes are all pretty effective. And what I like about that is that they're not the same scene. It's not like one scene, like one sequence, they fall in love with each other. Like there's very much the sense of like when he meets her for the first time and she like is at the window and convinces the construction workers to try to do something like to not work there so that way they can have the door open. That moment really impresses him and captures his eye in a different way. And then when they have that scene together and he's kind of, and he asks her out, it shows that it's her mind and her intelligence is really what is drawing him to her, as well as mm-hmm. the fact that she's just this beautiful woman. And then for her, definitely seems like she's kind of more interested at first just because, oh, he's a professor and he's taking an interest in me and that's nice. But then there's that scene where like she realizes that he like she's observing him and how like unconventional he is and how different he is from other people. And that sustains her interest for a while. But you can tell that that also is grading over time. And then they have that moment where he gives her this nice gift of this yeah. precious gem. And he calls back to a reference to a conversation that they had at this point many months ago that she was convinced in the moment that he wasn't even listening to what she was saying. And it shows that there's more to him than you initially realize, and that he's processing the world just in a different way. And I think that that really is what captures her long-term interest in him. So I think that the movie does give us that. Point. Yeah. And given the fact that it is this movie that spans decades and has a lot of stuff going on, it's impressive that they can give us such small intimate moments to establish this romantic relationship. What do you think about that, Marshall?
100%. 100%. When Noah was talking, I was like, but what about that time when he was? I was thinking right there with you, Alex. But I mean, and on top of that, I mean, there are small indicators before he meets Alicia that, you know, he got a little game. He looks at things a little bit differently. And the scene that sticks out to me with this is of course the one where they all went out for drinks. And you know, he kind of stumbles into his first big, kind of breakthrough, but that interpersonal, examination of that, you know, that set is what really does it for him. But you can also see, like, if he really wanted to, he probably could have got the blind, but he was thinking outside of the box. And I think that speaks to what you were saying, Alex, as far as how John Nash sees the world and how he sees himself. He sees his friends, his everything is a part of this model that he's been putting together and he's probably been working on. And just the way that expresses itself. Also, one of the big reasons why I was connected to this film the way I was is because I was actually in a pre-engineering curriculum at the time of my high school. So it was very much for me a practical view of what could happen if you were to, you know, listen to what my teachers were trying to tell us and create these models and, you know, the way that he's following the pigeons around, trying to model their behavior and create an algorithm. And this is how it happens. And I thought that was beautiful as well, as far as the interplay between his life and his studies and how they were intertwined.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's notable because, I mean, I don't think that we get a lot of stories about true life engineers, mathematicians, things like that, letting them be the hero of the story in a big Hollywood movie. So that totally makes sense that would be something that you would be pulled towards, especially at that age when you're just really looking for that sort of validation out there in the world. Like, how do I'm in this room, I'm learning these from these books, but how does that get translated into a life? And this is certainly an unconventional life to model yours after, but it's nice to have that as a story.
It just occurred to me, we did recently get a film like that tries something similar with The Imitation Game. I think this is way better than The Imitation Game. to be perfectly honest.
It's, and that, I think that the Imitation Game owes a lot to A Beautiful Mind. It's definitely in that same vein as in terms of what type of movie it's trying to be. And I would agree. I think this is probably a bit better than the Imitation
Game. It's a pale imitation. Take me away, Ed Harris.
But something that we haven't gotten into yet, which is kind of central to this film, is the twist of it all, right? So this movie is very much built around this idea that the audience is following John Nash's experience and at a certain point has to question whether what is happening to John Nash is real, whether he has been enlisted as a spy in the U.S. government, which is not totally unreasonable to believe given the time period and the fact that he was an Ivy League mathematician and the ways in which that is been utilized for the fight against Nazis in '30s and '40s and communists thereafter, definitely is not out of the realm of possibility. So we have to ask, is he enlisted as this spy, this codebreaker, or is he someone who's lost his grip on reality? And if he is someone who's lost his grip on humanity, just how deep does that go? How much of what we've seen is actually not real as far as we, like, as far as the true definition of reality can be used there. So I'm curious, Noah, I'm going to start with you. What was your experience watching it through this time, obviously knowing that the twist came, and what was your experience if you remember it the first time through?
It's hard to say. This is one of those films very much like The Sixth Sense, where once you've seen it the one time, you can't run the experiment again. You can't you can't rewatch the movie tabula rasa and you know, try again to see if you can, you know, spot the twist coming. Like, you've seen it once, you know it. All you can do is go back and, like, see, oh, now this and this and this make more sense. So what I look for this time is, because I think I was vaguely aware, if I'm recalling correctly, and I'm not sure that I am, I was vaguely aware of the premise of the movie and knew there was some form of twist coming. Maybe the extent to it, the fact that it was pretty much all of the government spy stuff, with the exception of maybe that one, because that would happen often, like a person would be called in once to analyze something, you know. So, like, I think it's pretty well established that first time that he calls in and meets a general is legitimate. And the one part of that that's fake is he sees the Ed Harris character. And revisiting this, I was looking to see, like, okay, how well does the movie, like, hide its hand? And it does a really good job of that. Like, if I can see myself or other people who have no prior knowledge of John Nash and of the story, maybe being able to guess it by the fact that, for example, you know, he makes the point of saying, oh, who's Big Brother in that first scene with the general when he sees the Ed Harris figure? And the guy doesn't even respond to that. And that could be because he's not there. It could be because the general's being dismissive because, well, this is all confidential and I shouldn't be telling him too much, you know? So it's like whatever your brain is preconceived towards, or the stuff with the roommate, that's more subtly done. The one possible tell is when he goes out with Charles, Paul Bettany kind of disappeared after this movie until he resurfaces Jarvis in the MCU, which is just wild. Like, he was in this and in Knight's Tale. I'd completely forgotten that he was also in the Knight's Tale at the same time until I looked at his Wikipedia page. They go out to a bar and they're playing billiards, and he, like, goes to the bathroom or something, and then the other students come in and are like, oh, who's winning, you or yourself? Like, implying that, you know, they, you know, don't see the other guy. That's really the only tell as far as Charles and his niece. And then I think later, if you're really smart, you pick up on the fact that, wait a minute, that girl should be older. And, like, he almost realizes it. John Nash almost realizes, like, wow, she's very small. And he's like, but it's kids. That's how they are. Kids are small. So it's, I think I was able to, and this is where the craft of Ron Howard and his, you know, crew come in. And really, like I said before, a lot of people tend to forget about Ron Howard in terms of, like, great, like, big filmmakers, of the past few decades. Probably because he's not, you know, he's not considered an auteur in the strictest sense of the word. But it's really like I grew to appreciate how the movie sets up the twist without, like, overplaying its hand, without dropping too big of a hint. Like, if you know it's coming, you can see the signs. Or if someone told you, oh, when you watch this movie, there's the twist, something in it isn't real. You know, if you know that going in and you're really observant, maybe you can catch the hints.
But so, Noah, aside from the surprise of it, like, yeah. Does it work? Does that experience work well for you, especially watching it the second time through, knowing what's coming?
It does. It does. It definitely does. Especially because, as we said before, that's really when Jennifer Connelly takes over, and her experience of, like, we see her convince herself that her husband is ill and needs help. That's great. Like, when she is following, you know, the track, she's going to the house that, like, the drop house, you know, mm-hmm. and discovering that's abandoned. That's, like, that's all great filmmaking. Like, that, and that's all a precursor to the really intense sequence later on. So I think it is one of those examples where it's a different experience. You can never experience the film cold twice. But it does. I do think that for the most part, it is a film that gains on repeated viewings because you can better appreciate how it sets up what's happening.
Yeah.
And I also have to say, he's not the focus of the movie, but Christopher Plummer as the psychiatrist coming in to explain everything, pitch perfect casting. Like, no notes.
Yeah.
No
one very else good casting because he, number one, is very effective as a authority figure on psychology. And number two, can definitely possibly be a Russian spy in disguise. I would believe him as that
also. That.
But Marshall, how about you? How did that, like, did that initial viewing kind of, like, blow your teenage mind at the time? And how does it affect future viewings of that movie?
Yeah, I mean, if a nod could be audible, then you would have been hearing it throughout everything that Noah said. I mean, when you look at this film, and what I appreciated more over the amount of times that I've seen it is how intricately the narrative was built to hide the fact. I went in the first time seeing it not knowing who John Nash was. So mm-hmm. for me, this twist was Sixthensian. Like, it was very much, I see dead people. Oh, Marcy doesn't age. Fuck. And what they did with that, and what I thought was so intricate about it, was they kind of left open spaces where there could be foreshadowing and kind of let your brain and your inherent bias fill that in, which I think is so difficult to do at the level that they were able to achieve it in hiding that reality. Because when I look at it, when I think about it again, the real tell, yes, is time. But then when you look at how it's edited, people don't really look much older. We don't really have a clear idea of how much time has passed. So it's kind of like it's right in your face, but it's hidden. It's veiled. And I just thought that was so important and so well done. Like, when you talk about Ron Howard as an artist, as a director, and how this was, I mean, this had to have been built. And you appreciate it upon your next viewings. Yeah, you'll never be able to take that maiden voyage again. But now you're just like looking like, oh shit, yeah that. Oh shit, yeah that. And there's not too much that you can really look back on and be like, yeah, that's when they said it. To the point, hey, are you playing? Who's winning? You or yourself? Like, you don't, going back, you're like, those fuckers told me. And.
Yeah, but in the moment, it just feels like those guys being jerks, right? Exactly. They're being like, oh, you're a loser. Like, you and must not be playing with anybody.
They build that comment beautifully throughout the beginning and seeing, you know, John playing with himself on the bench. And you, this is something that John does. So it makes perfect sense. You don't really think like, oh, this is them being out of the ordinary because John is doing something out of the ordinary. No, this is what John does all the time. This is just John. And I just, you know, just the way that they built it, it was so well done for me. And it's, and like I said, it's a movie that I always go back to. And that's part of it, because every time you're going to see something slightly different, you're going to have a different appreciation due to your life experience. I'm 34. I'll be 35 in February. Like, I'm a different person now, and I can appreciate a lot more within their relationship and how difficult that was on Alicia's part, and appreciate Jennifer better, because it's not that your husband's lying to you. What do you do? What do you do when he's not lying to you, but you can't trust him?
It's heartbreaking. It's a heartbreaking thing to be stuck in the middle of, you know, and I think she conveys that so well. I do want to give some credit to Akiva Goldsmith. He is the writer of the screenplay, and this was Ron Howard got the rights to this, to the biography of John Nash and was very excited about making this movie, and they had a number of different screenwriters in to try to decide how to kind of tackle this story. And Akiva is the one who decided to eschew the sort of like traditional, like specific details of his story and create a more like ecstatic truth version of things, where it kind of capture the spirit of it for a cinematic experience versus trying to give the literal experience that John Nash had. And so those ideas of like having changing the hallucination from auditory hallucinations to full-on visual hallucinations, creating these like fictional people who the real John Nash didn't have anything to do with, but in the film does, like that was his idea, and building the whole movie around this twist at the center and having the audience kind of be to fall for it too, that was all Akiva Goldsmith's choice. And Howard obviously saw the vision in that and decided to go with it, and that's where they ended up going. But right, he definitely deserves credit there. Marshall, you might know Akiva Goldsmith as the creator of Titans, the HBO Max series about the Teen Titans. He's done a lot of interesting genre stuff over the years, and mixed in with some of the Prestige. I am
instantly less impressed with him.
Also the screenwriter of, you know, before this movie, he was the screenwriter of Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. So really impressive that he was able to land a script of this nature. But
it's what happens when you continuously work on your craft, because I think we could all agree that those movies are wanting. Titans is not my favorite thing. We've talked about it on one of our podcasts multiple times where I'm just kind of like out of it. But what he did here, if this is, you know, the collection of things, of other things that he done, this is his magnum opus. Because you're right, Alex. It was such a smart decision, because, of course, when you think about this, right, we have to put this to a visual medium. And if I go back and I think about it, when I watched the movie, of course, I would probably watch it right after this again, just to check. But there are no scenes where John Nash is visibly talking to himself. The only time you ever see that is when there's another character in the vicinity, and then the camera switches to their point of view. But if John Nash is on screen, you're seeing everything that he thinks he's seeing. And I can't remember a time where that's not the case, unless there's another character. And so just translating that, being able to look at that psychopathy and being able to say, okay, this is the way to translate it to film. What was a brilliant choice. And I understand that certain things had to be taken for dramatic effect and certain things had to be dramatized, but that move right there was genius.
And I have to say, that's the aspect of the film that I was pleasantly surprised by. I expected to find that more grating and more irritating revisiting the movie a decade later. But I was struck yesterday rewatching the film by how much it worked. Aesthetically, within the emotional core, and as the emotional core of the film, so it's I feel much better about that than like other cases where movies have vastly altered the true story for very questionable purposes.
Yeah, and I think there's a different way that you can go with this story where you are more true to the actual experience of having auditory hallucinations and take advantage of some of the things that a film can do in terms of the impressionistic visual and auditory experience that a film can provide. But in that, if you went in that direction, you would know that the protagonist was not experiencing reality, but that he was struggling with his perception of reality, and you would be struggling with that perception with him, and that would have a certain impact on you. I think this way is a way that is going to make that sort of thing much more accessible to like general audiences, which could be considered a detriment, right? But I think it does end up capturing something really interesting, especially in that middle piece of the movie where finally, like, all of the chips are down and we know what the deal is, and then we get to see what that experience is like, and we can kind of empathize in a different way with Russell Crowe's John Nash as a result of that. So, you know, I could see the argument for and against it, but I do agree that it is, you know, it leads to some of the better scenes in the film. So I think that's undeniable. And speaking of those hallucinations, I do, you know, before we move on to sort of the bigger conversation around this movie, we haven't really talked that much about Ed Harris or Paul Bettany, and both of them are kind of the anchors to that hallucination portion of the film. And I'm curious, like, how they worked for you, both when you thought that they were real and how they worked for you once you realized that they weren't and they were these specters of his subconscious in a lot of ways, Marshall.
I think the smartest thing that they did was, me personally, I thought that making Paul Bettany not a mathematician or a statistics student or a STEM major, I think that was able to kind of subtly explain his haphazardness or his mindset, his contrast with John, which I thought was a very strong point for them to begin with. And that journey of them being, you know, roommates and friends. And yeah, I thought it was really well done. I mean, Paul Bettany is an amazing actor. He bagged Jennifer Connelly somehow. So, I mean, there's always bonus points for that. But with him and Ed, they both chew up the screen when they're there. They play off of Russell Crowe so well. And really, it's interesting because they kind of have arcs as parts of John's condition. Like, they're, you know, they have stories, like, you know, Paul Bettany tells him about his niece, and then you end up meeting the niece. And then, you know, with Ed Harris, he's just such an asshole. It works. Yeah. It works. It just works.
I agree. I think that they're both such great casting for those roles. Like, Ed Harris as the sort of, like, nefarious, like, you know,
government type guy.
Yeah. Yeah, just like perfect, like, as like, and also, like, thinking about, like, well, why would John Nash project this as a part of his experience? And it's like that sort of, like, aggro alpha male, like, man on a mission sort of thing definitely makes sense, and Ed Harris really captures that well. And whereas Paul Bettany is exposing this other kind of the softer and more chaotic, more, you know, humanities side to him, and I think he's really great casting as well. It's just a sort of, like, you know, it's it's funny that he ended up getting cast as a robot, you know, in the MCU, because he really does have this sort of, like, inhuman look to him. Like, it's like he's, depending on how you see him, what angle he's on screen at any given time, he's like the most beautiful man that's ever existed, or just like a funhouse mirror version of a beautiful man, where you're just like, that something about him is, like, transfixing and also not quite right. And I feel like that is perfect for a fantasy person, you know. So I think that was, and I think he's so good. He just, like, he conveys a lot of empathy and emotion for John Nash. His scenes with Russell Crowe are really strong. So I really like him in this movie.
Yeah, I think those two casting performances work because they're two different facets of John Nash's personality. Like, Paul Bettany is, like, on a personal level, he's the opposite of John Nash. He's outgoing, he's charismatic, he's funny. Like, you could see him, he could go into any room in any bar and just be the center of the party. Like, he has that vibe to him. And he's, you know, a jokester, and he's loose. So it's like John Nash is creating the person that he's not and knows he's not and maybe wishes that he was. And so through that kind of creates this kind of, you know, chaos goblin to be kind of his own, like, mirror self. And then with Ed Harris, I think the macho aggro, like big, you know, big dick government person type of energy, I think that's a part of it. I think it's also he embodies John Nash's deep-seated desire for importance, because we have all this setup of him complaining, like, oh, like, I'm stuck here teaching, you know, dumb college students, as opposed to doing something that matters and doing something important. And he has that scene where he, you know, he sees the inner, like, this pen ceremony, which doesn't exist. Princeton does not do a pen ceremony for professors. They made that up in the movie. But it signifies his desire for recognition. He wants recognition. He wants everyone to turn to him and say, you're a genius. You did something that we never could. And Ed Harris's character literally says, you're the best natural code breaker I've ever seen. You're the most natural genius. You're the only person who can save America and stop the Cold War. Like, it's pure ego feeding. So it's like, it's different aspects of John Nash's, like, deep-seated psychological needs or wants that his subconscious is kind of funneled into these two characters. But yeah, so I think that's what makes both of those characters perfect, and both of the casting choices to embody them as well, especially Ed Harris. I just double-checked Ed Harris's filmography. This came out just 2 or 3 years after The Truman Show. Mm-hmm. So Ed Harris was like, especially for anyone seeing the movie at the time, would have instantly gotten, oh, it's that guy. You know, the big overlord who's just magically everywhere and knows everything. And somehow he outfitted an abandoned shed in the woods to be a whole government like surveillance apparatus. Of course, Ed Harris would do that. So there are multiple layers to the casting there that just work in every level. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the
cast is great. Even like the tiny minor characters, like, I don't think there's a bad casting choice in the entire film.
No, you know, like Anthony Rapp and Adam Goldberg have small roles in as like the sort of, you know, the Princeton boys, if you will. And yeah, I think everybody's really strong.
Josh Lucas was incredible.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Josh Lucas fan, but other people like him. I'm glad
he was good here. He was good here. But just being that guy with the punchable face. Just being that guy with the punchable face and just antagonizing John and just being that, like, he plays the role. I don't know
about I guess,
as an actor, but he played the role well.
Certainly, many people agree that that's a good lane for him. He's never really, I've seen him a number of times in that sort of role and it never really works well for me. But obviously other people agree with you, Marshall, because he gets cast in those roles quite often. So, but there's something flat about him that never really works for me. But lots of things worked for a lot of people when it came to this movie, because it was, as we mentioned earlier, a huge Academy Award player in that year when it came out, the year 2001, for the 2002 ceremony. It was nominated for 8 Oscars, won 4 pretty impressively, including Best Picture and Best Director. In addition to the one that we mentioned earlier, Jennifer Connelly getting Best Supporting Actress, and it did win for Kiva Goldsmith for screenplay. It was also nominated for Russell Crowe in the lead role, Best Film Editing, Best Makeup, and Best Original Score by James Horner. And I do think that this score is very pretty. I think it's a very effective score.
Yes, I had forgotten that James Horner scored this movie until I saw his name come up the credits. It's like, oh, it's...
Yeah.
You can always go with a good James Horner score.
That man's never had a bad score in his entire illustrious career, so definitely.
I would second that. Rest in peace.
But it's interesting to look at like the movies that it beat for Best Picture, for instance. You know, like the Best Picture category that year was A Beautiful Mind, Gosford Park, In the Bedroom, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, and Moulin Rouge. So and you know, all of those people who were nominated for Best Picture, almost all of them made it to Best Director as well. The only difference is Todd Field didn't get a Best Director nomination. Instead, they went with a guy named David Lynch for Mulholland Drive. So,
small-time filmmaker. You may have heard of him. I have to say, I looked at these lists for these nominations. My first reaction was, what the fuck is Gosford Park? Why have I never heard of this?
You've never heard of Gosford Park? It's Robert Altman's like last movie, I'm pretty sure.
That's probably on me.
It's basically like a proto, like Downton Abbey. It's about like a British like manor house and like the upstairs and downstairs.
That explains the presence of Helen Mirren and Maggie Smith.
Yes.
There was probably some vote splitting going on there. I can imagine that, you know, maybe helping Jennifer Connelly out. But still, like, to go up against those two figures plus Kate Winslet and to come out on top is...
And Marissa Tomei in In the Bedroom, which is a really great performance. And, you know, former Oscar winner Marissa Tomei. So... before she was being romanced by Happy Hogan, she was doing some pretty great work in the bedroom. So yeah, that category was really stacked, you know, in
all best the top actor, categories.
Best actor, Russell Crowe didn't repeat. He didn't get 2 in a row, but it's very interesting because many people think that because the Oscars went so crazy for A Beautiful Mind, that had he not won the year before for Gladiator, that he very likely would have won this year. And that is a very interesting sort of, you know, alternative history, because of course Denzel Washington for Training Day beat him out here, and I think that that is a really great pick by the Oscars, and it would be a shame if that didn't happen. But yeah, it's very,
you can't feel sore about losing to Denzel Washington. I mean, come on,
not in that role. There are two roles that I feel like Denzel Washington should have won, and I think he actually won for. I don't remember or not. You guys can probably tell me, but if you can't, no worries. I thought he should have won for Malcolm X.
He didn't win for Malcolm X, but he definitely should have.
And then Training Day. So it was three. Like, there's, I mean, it's one of those things where you watch Training Day, you just kind of like, you hey, GG's, man. Like, and then there would have been unrest in the streets had Denzel not won Best Actor for that role. He was, I mean, that performance should be in the Library of Congress among, you know, a lot of Russell's performances. But yeah, you wasn't beating Denzel that year for that movie for that role.
And he definitely shouldn't have. Denzel definitely deserved it, and in a really stacked field. Like, I mean, I think that in my opinion, you know, Russell Crowe might be the worst performance of the. Well, no, Sean Penn is definitely the worst performance in that category. It's Denzel for Training Day, Russell Crowe for A Beautiful Mind, Sean Penn for I Am Sam, Will Smith for Ali, and Tom Wilkinson for In the Bedroom. And I would probably rank Crowe fourth out of five on that one. But it's a really stacked year. And then, you know, in terms of like best director, I just think it's really interesting that Ron Howard managed to win. Obviously, they got best picture, so people really liked it. But, you know, Ridley Scott for Black Hawk Down is a legend. Obviously, Black Hawk Down didn't get best picture, so I guess there wasn't as much enthusiasm for it and as you might have expected. But that's definitely one of the best war films of that era, at the very least. Robert Altman, legend for Gosford Park. Peter Jackson, I mean, we know now that they were saving it for the third movie, but that was not a surefire assumption at the time. Like, there was a chance that those movies could have fallen apart and they would have missed their chance to nominate him. And then David Lynch for Mulholland Drive, which is just like a remarkable achievement of, Baz Luhrmann didn't get best director for Moulin Rouge, didn't even get the nomination, which I think is surprising, because I might have given it to him if I was in charge that year.
I'm gonna check this now. But I feel like if Lord of the Rings, if this movie had not come out alongside Lord of the Rings, A Beautiful Mind might have won even more Oscars, because it was nominated for Best Makeup, but that went to Fellowship of the Ring. Fellowship of the Ring also won out for Original Score, which, of course, but like if those two were not in competition, I could have seen James Horner for this score coming out ahead. So like, you could have been looking at A Beautiful Mind walking away with six or seven Oscars, like really major sweep territory, if it hadn't been going up against, you know, the first of this massive fantasy trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
interesting bit of what if history there, now that I'm really looking at it.
And Marshall, just to double back around to something you mentioned earlier, I looked it up. Denzel Washington, his only two wins are for Training Day, as we said, and for the movie Glory, which he got Best Supporting Actor in 1989.
Did not win for Fences?
He did not win for Fences. He has one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine Oscar nominations total, but only two wins. Those other nominations include Cry Freedom in 1988. He was nominated for Malcolm X, but did not win. I think pretty notoriously, most people think that he should have won that year. Then we have The Hurricane in 2000, where he lost to Russell Crowe. So it was a nice kind of like turning it around on that one. Russell Crowe won in 2001 for the 2000 performance. So that was the year prior. Then Training Day in 2002, he won. He was nominated in 2013 for Flight, lost that year. He was nominated.
Oh, I thought he won for Flight. Wow.
He didn't win for Flight. It was kind of a miracle that he got nominated for Flight, because that movie was not anywhere else in the Oscars that year. But he managed to get the leading actor nomination. And then Fences, he got nominated for but didn't win. And Roman J. Israel Esquire, he was nominated for, didn't win. And most recently, Tragedy of Macbeth, which he is excellent in, he was nominated for but didn't win. So
Not a little Oscar. I've been scrolling down because I wanted to find out. I thought the Fellowship of the Ring won Best Editing, but Beautiful Mind and Fellowship of the Ring both lost out to Black Hawk Down.
Yeah, which makes sense. There's some really incredible editing sequences in that movie.
Oh, and Memento was nominated.
Yeah, that's pretty.
Look at Christopher Nolan coming out the gate.
All sorts of that is a. That might be, for me, this might be one of the most fascinating Academy Award years in retrospect, like looking back 20 years in the future. A lot of interesting stuff and interesting names popping up in like all the categories.
Yeah, would have been cool if Guy Pearce got in there for Memento over Sean Penn in Best Lead Actor. But, you know, that would have been, I think, a little too edgy for this version of the Oscars.
Yeah, I was going to say, if both movies came out today, I feel like, because Memento just became such a cultural, like a cult. Like hit much more than, you know, the Sean Penn movie. And not to say Sean Penn isn't a great actor. I feel about Sean Penn how you feel about Josh.
Lucas.
He's just I just never been overly impressed with him. But it's
and I Am Sam is the one where he's playing a person who has, you know, mental issues. Like I believe he has Down syndrome or something along those lines. So it's like really not great. That's the sort of movie that just like couldn't get made now. Like if you make that now, like everyone just gets canceled, just like goes to jail.
There was a lot of that going on in the 80s and 90s. That's kind of I think over time I started to lump A Beautiful Mind into the rest of those like what's it called, one of them, I think it was the first Oscar Daniel Day-Lewis got My Left Foot, stuff like that.
But it's like the Rain Man effect, right? Like Dustin Hoffman does it for Rain Man, and then like a dozen other people do it in the next 10 years after that.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like Cuba Gooding Jr. for Radio is another.
And I think it's fair to say that. I think it's fair to kind of say, okay, not all of them need to be equally bad. Like we've been talking about how A Beautiful Mind, like it doesn't feel cheap. It doesn't feel like it feels. How can I put it? Like Alex, you said you felt it, that you felt you were critical at parts of the movie for Russell Crowe's affectations, but like it's ultimately you felt like it was less offensive or egregious than like other examples. Mm-hmm. Am I paraphrasing you correctly?
That's more or less what I agree with what I said earlier in the episode. Thankfully, I haven't changed my mind. But one last thing on this Oscar year that I think is really interesting, and I'm curious if you guys would agree that this is how they should have gone. One of the awards that A Beautiful Mind did get is that screenplay award for Best Adapted Screenplay, and they were up against Ghost World, which is really great. Little movie by Terry Zwigoff that I just love that it got nominated at all. Really good early Scarlett Johansson movie. Also In the Bedroom, which is a really strong Todd Field script. Lord of the Rings Fellowship of the Ring, of course. And then Shrek, which only in 2001 could Shrek have gotten in there on a screenplay nomination. But what do you guys think?
I don't know, man. Shrek is a strong movie, though. Like Shrek ages incredibly well.
For me, Shrek 2 ages better, though. Like, if we were talking about Shrek 2, I would be more understanding. That is, Shrek won the first Academy Award for Best Animated Feature, which will never not be insane.
It beat Jimmy Neutron Boy Genius and Monsters, Inc.
Those underrated. Jimmy Neutron is underappreciated.
Spirited Away came out that year, but didn't get nominated.
It was the next year. Spirited Away was nominated. Next year. Yeah.
Okay.
No. Okay. If Shrek had beaten Spirited Away, in a different universe. It's so okay. I'm biased. Like, I definitely don't think that Shrek would have deserved the award better than this. I'm such a Lord of the Rings nerd. In my opinion, all three Lord of the Rings movies should have won every Oscar for everything. So, the other two, I just haven't seen them, so
Have you seen Ghost Worlds, Marshall? I think you both would like it a lot. It's great. It's a great little movie about like these two like teenage girls who are who've just graduated from high school, about to start off their adult life, and they kind of run into a Steve Buscemi, who is this kind of like older guy who's this older guy who is a collector of like very obscure records from a million years ago, and it's just kind of like this great like coming of age story about these two women. So it's a great movie. Okay. Elena Douglas is really, really funny in it also. So
I think what I'm trying to say is, accounting for my Fellowship of the Ring bias, I think this is a deserving win for this movie. That's what I was trying to say.
Nice. Well, the Fellowship of the Ring like was such. It kind of reminded me of the whole discourse around Watchmen about like how this movie is like unmakeable or something like that. That's not exactly the discourse around that trilogy, but it's so hard to do what Peter Jackson did for the sheer amount of content that needed to be translated to screen. I mean, I'm not necessarily arguing with that point, Noah, that it should have won so many things. I don't think the acting was outstanding, but I don't know if it was nominated for acting. But just from a standpoint of bringing this world, this pantheon of content to the screen, it was incredible.
I have to say, the lack of acting nominations for the only acting nomination was Ian McKellen in this year for supporting actor. So that it was not a competition with Beautiful Mind. Beautiful Mind had no supporting actor nominations. Ian McKellen was up against other competitions and didn't win. That was the only acting nomination. That is a sore point for me. I'm willing to get into arguments over the worthiness of the acting in those movies.
But that we'll have to save that for another time. Bringing it back to the point of this conversation, which is to celebrate the film A Beautiful Mind and Marshall's love of it. I'm going to let Marshall have the last word. For people who listen to this episode and haven't actually seen the movie or haven't watched it in a very long time, is there anything you want to say to them to try to get them to give it another chance or give it another look?
Well, first off, spoiler alert. other than that, no. I mean, honestly, it's what I would call a thinking person's movie. And some people don't, you know, watch film for that. But if indeed you want to sit down with a beautiful narrative, an amazing cast, great cinematography. I outside of that one snafu, which I've noticed before, I thought the editing was fantastic. I think it's just structurally, if you are a listener of Cinema Joes and you haven't seen this film, you should, because it is cinema. And I don't know that it would be as excellent as it would be today in the Marvelverse that we live in and when it comes to movies. But if a little engine that could, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, can do what it did, I still feel like A Beautiful Mind could stand in this day and age. It's just a damn good film. It has something for everyone. So highly recommend. Highly.
Great. Okay. And I think that's a great way to end this conversation.
I don't think we can put it any better than that.
Absolutely. So, Marshall, if people enjoyed your conversation here, they can, of course, listen back to your review of The Batman, which we had a couple months ago. You and your wife, Courtney, came on. We're very gracious with your time to talk about that 3-hour-long epic film that we all enjoyed. But in addition to that, where else can our audience find more of your work?
Yeah, definitely. Take a look at us. You can find us at The Old Comic Council on Twitch, YouTube, Patreon, Instagram, Twitter. You can also find our podcast projects through the Pop Break, popbreak.com. Blurred Watchers is our monthly show, which we'll be getting back to. And also Blurred Life with My Wife is on Spotify, Anchor, all of your podcast services. That is our lifestyle podcast. Very similar, but we do tackle different things, and I'm very excited to be able to work with one as brilliant as she, which you guys were able to have conversation with. So I'm a bit luckier that I get to do it more often.
Absolutely. And the two of you were both on Goodbye to All That this past month to talk about The Boys Season 3. That's Michael T. Ford III's podcast, also on Pop Break TV. So definitely check that out as well. I haven't, because I haven't caught up with The Boys yet. I watched the first season and kind of fell off. But a lot of people had a lot to say about this season, so I'm sure that your conversation was really fantastic.
Appreciate the assist and linking us with Michael. He's awesome.
Yeah, he's so great. He's so great. I love what he's done with that show. Now, Noah, how about you? Where can we find your stuff on the internet?
Well, as Alex mentioned at the start, in addition to my work on Cinema Joes, you guys should check out the music podcast that they're doing with their other co-host, Justin Mancini. We are currently on the Rush Hour, where we go back through the entire discography of Rush, and you should definitely check out our previous musical podcast, Pod on the Rooftops, where we explored all the albums of the prog rock band Genesis. And as for me, you can find me on Twitter at Noah France, and you can also check out all of my written stuff at francenoir.blogspot.com.
Great. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow this show on Twitter at Cinema Joes and subscribe to Cinema Joes' all major podcast platforms. You can follow my work as the podcast editor of thepopbreak.com by going on to thepopbreak.com and clicking on the podcast tab, where I am producing lots and lots of shows on movies and music and culture at large, television, all the rest. I host two shows over there. One is The TV Break, which is a TV podcast about all the news and reviews coming out that month, and also Bill versus the MCU, where I, along with co-host Bill Bodkin, have been rewatching all of the MCU, and we are approaching the end of our rewatch, but we have plans for the fall that or for next year rather that you'll be hearing about very soon about what we'll be doing with that show moving forward. So definitely keep an eye on that as well. And you know, that's about it. Thanks everyone else for listening. Thanks to our subscribers, our listeners. Thanks to Marshall. Special shout out to Courtney. Just to say hi, because I love to say hi to her. She's super fun. She always gives me a nice support on Twitter when I go off on my rants. And yeah, so and also, of course, thank you to Justin, who couldn't be here today. You can follow him on his website, The Cinemaverick, and The Cinemaverick on Letterboxd as well. So, in fact, he's not here with us. He can't say goodbye, so I have to do it instead. So, bye, everybody.